This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has scored a decisive election victory to win a sixth term, the country's election commission said on Saturday. But his main rival, Bobi Wine, denounced the results as fraudulent and urged citizens to reject them. The 76-year-old Museveni has held power since 1986 and is one of Africa's longest-serving leaders. He won 5.85 million votes, or 58.6%, in Thursday's election. Wine had 3.48 million votes, or 34.8%, the Electoral Commission said in announcing the final results. The campaign was marked by a deadly crackdown by security forces on Wine, a 38-year-old singer-turned-lawmaker, as well as on other opposition candidates and their supporters. The United States and an African election monitoring group complained of election irregularities. The government ordered the internet shut off the day before the vote and has not yet restored it. And the government on Tuesday banned all social media and messaging apps. Wine and his supporters often use Facebook to relay live coverage of his campaign. In the United States, Washington, D.C. was locked down, and U.S. law enforcement officials geared up for marches supporting U.S. President Donald Trump in all 50 state capitals this weekend. They erected barriers and deployed thousands of National Guard troops to try to prevent the kind of violent attack that rattled the nation on January 6. The FBI warned police agencies of possible armed protests outside all 50 state capitol buildings starting Saturday through U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration on January 20th, all fueled by supporters of President Trump who believe his claims of electoral fraud. The heightened security follows the deadly January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol in Washington by a mix of extremists and Trump supporters. This is VOA News. A team of climbers from Nepal on Saturday became the first mountaineers to successfully complete a winter attempt on the summit of K2, which is the world's second tallest peak. The group of Sherpas had paused at a point 70 meters short of the roughly 8,600 meter peak to wait for each other, that before climbing into the world's history books together at 4:56 p.m. Located on the Pakistan-China border, K2 is the only mountain over 8,000 meters that has not been summited in the winter. The group member's success, though, was marred by the death on the mountain of renowned Spanish climber Sergio Mingote. He fell down a crevice as he attempted to make his way down to base camp, according to reporting by Reuters. K2 is notorious for its steep slopes and high winds, and in winter, its surface becomes slick ice. The Pakistani military is regularly called in to rescue climbers using helicopters, but the weather often makes that difficult. The coronavirus pandemic has meant restrictions on travel severely impacted the traditional summer mountaineering season in the range, and Pakistan in particular, which is home to 5 of the world's 14 peaks over 8,000 meters. Foreign ministers of China and the Philippines on Saturday committed to prioritizing post-pandemic recovery efforts as senior Chinese diplomat Wang Yi wrapped up a week-long visit to 4 Southeast Asian countries. The Philippines in March imposed one of the world's longest and strictest lockdowns to contain the virus, grounding to a halt what was one of Asia's fastest-growing economies before the pandemic. A plane carrying 1 million doses of Sinopharm's COVID-19 vaccine arrived on Saturday in Serbia, making it the first European country to receive the Chinese vaccine for mass inoculation programs. Serbia's president was accompanied by Beijing's ambassador to the Balkan country at Belgrade's airport as containers carrying the vaccine were unloaded from an Air Serbia plane. U.S. President Donald Trump, in a last-minute push to solidify Morocco's normalization with Israel, has bestowed a rare award on its king as Trump's administration rallied international support in a regional dispute. Trump, who sees Arab recognition of Israel as a key overseas achievement of his presidency, last month broke decades of precedent by recognizing Morocco's full sovereignty over contested Western Sahara. In turn, Morocco said it would normalize relations with the Jewish state. Be remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here is the issue. After a week that saw a riot led by supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump, that breached the U.S. Capitol building in an attempted overthrow of the government and left five people dead, history was made as the House of Representatives voted to impeach Trump for the second time. House members voted on one count of inciting violence against the government of the United States. The motion was approved by a vote of 232 to 197, a tally which included 10 members of Trump's own Republican Party, making it the most bipartisan impeachment vote in history. Democrats, speaking from the same floor they were forced to flee for their lives just 1 week ago, made impassioned speeches demanding that the president be held accountable for inciting the unprecedented melee that tore through the Capitol. Republican arguments defending the president ranged from lukewarm to defiant. Notable among the 10 who voted to impeach was Representative Liz Cheney, a prominent figure in the Republican House delegation and daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney. Trump, banned from the social media outlets that he has depended on throughout his political life, has been largely silent in the days following the insurrection, save for one public appearance where he professed that he had done, quote, nothing wrong. Following the impeachment vote, Trump released a statement disavowing the violence at the Capitol and bemoaning the social media ban, but making no mention of the impeachment vote. The article now goes to the Senate for a trial. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he will not reconvene the Senate for an emergency session before Trump leaves office, leaving it to the incoming Democrat-led Senate to manage an impeachment trial at the same time it tries to launch the agenda of soon-to-be President Joe Biden. Emily, JJ, welcome. Good morning. And we keep saying it over and over again for 4 years, but we have unprecedented events to talk about today. The president being impeached twice, half the impeachments in U.S. history have the name of Donald Trump on them. I just want to jump right in with you, Emily. The charge that was a president, could you give like a brief explanation of what the charge is? And can charges be added to this, or is it likely to be just the one count that goes to the Senate?
So inciting an insurrection kind of does what it says on the tin, right? He was charged with, I guess, to use a metaphor, sparking the fuse that led to the mob storming the Capitol in the weeks of denying the legitimacy of the election, and then more to the point in this rally that in calling his supporters to town on January 6th and having this rally and sort of whipping up the crowd. I think that it will probably just be this. I think the House wanted to sort of do it one and done and pass it along to the Senate. I would also just note that while it is historic that the president managed to get impeached twice in 1 4-year term, as he is leaving in a week anyway, the impact will really be felt if the Senate convicts, and convicts obviously not just to remove from office, but because he'll be gone, but convicts to bar him from ever holding office again. So history is still unfolding on this one.
JJ, let's go to you. We have the arguments for impeachment, the Democrats and the Republicans giving their respective positions on this. Were there any arguments or speeches on either side that stood out for you?
No. And considering that I stay away from politics, I would have to comment on this from a security point of view. What I heard from some people seemed to add credence to this divide or divorce from reality by some people. We all saw what happened. We all saw what led up to it. And as you mentioned, Michael, when we started this, we've been talking about this for years. And having been on this program for several years, certainly since 2016 or shortly thereafter, this has been a big topic. And that big topic being things like, quote, alternative facts, or things like the president's viewpoint, which is different from reality. And just basically the trafficking in lies. What took place on the floor was more of that in some situations where people didn't even address what took place in the president's speech, didn't even address what it essentially was doing, and, you know, did not connect it to what took place at the Capitol. Instead, we're talking about what Democrats do, how Democrats are, or how other political parties and other people act and what they've done, not addressing the critical point that faces this nation right now. So that's what I took most note of from many of the speeches that took place on the floor. There was this divide.
Yeah, and as you say, speaking from the security aspect, they were literally speaking from a crime scene, making these arguments. It was really just a stunning and affecting to watch. Emily, I'll turn to you with the same question. Of the speeches that you saw on the floor, both defending and indicting the president, were there any that stood out in your mind?
Yes, there were two on each side. So on the Democratic side, I was really struck by Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas saying, "What do you think they would have done if they had gotten in? What do you think they would have done to you? And who do you think sent them here?" That to me was chilling. It drove home how close Democrats and Republicans in Congress came to, you know, what happened on January 6th was horrible, but this recalled for me how much worse it could have been. The other one was Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, who said that it was a bit much to hear that the mob that tried to kill them would have been less angry had they been a little bit nicer. I think that that, to me, illustrated what I think rings hollow to many about this argument that, well, if you impeach, then we're not going to heal. If you impeach, then there won't be unity. If you impeach, then we're going to be really mad. And it's sort of like, well, you already stormed the Capitol, right? How much more anger and divisions there going to be. On the Republican side, you know, there were many who said, "I think that this is an impeachable offense, but I don't think that it's right for the nation," or who said, "Well, let's have a bipartisan commission instead." I was struck, though, by Matt Gaetz of Florida, who got up and spoke about the Biden crime family, right? Just showing that there are still members of Congress who are not letting the conspiracy theories from the election go. And also Lee Zeldin from New York, who spoke about MS-13 and the embassy and Trump's moving the embassy to Jerusalem. And the reason I bring this up is just that I think that there were members who voted against impeaching Trump for whom the issue was not really impeachment. It was whether their political futures would be tied to Trump or not.
Yeah, there are some members who clearly are for Trump and to the end. They will literally ride that horse into the sunset. And they made that very clear with the speeches that they gave, which made virtually no mention, as you say, of a deadly attack, which is their place of business. Now, I'm going to stay with you, Emily, to talk a little bit about the president and the statements that he's given in the days since. It seems that there's sort of the seesaw of statements that he makes, where he said that he had done nothing wrong in a recent public appearance, and then later that same day gives a statement saying that he denounces all violence and no one violent is a supporter of his. Which one of these represents the real Donald Trump?
You know, I'm a little surprised that every time he puts out one of these slightly calmer videos, people sort of go for it, right? And say that, well, now that was a good statement. And you know what? I think they're both Donald Trump, because the one is obviously the sort of the public showman Donald Trump that people who go to his rallies love. But the other is still Donald Trump, because he is telling people what he thinks they want to hear, which I think is also something that we've seen Trump do repeatedly as a candidate and as president.
JJ, we have this impeachment that has happened. We have had this process that's gone through the House of Representatives, and we're going to have a trial. How important is it for this to happen for national security? Can we actually count on a resolution of what is a growing domestic terrorist threat without holding people responsible for their actions, both the people who actually did the actions, who breached the walls, and the people who incited them to do it?
Yeah, I'd like to point out two things for your consideration on this. On the day this riot took place, we have video images of people with ropes, ladders, sledgehammers, hockey sticks, metal pipes, flex cuffs or zip ties, people with weapons, guns. Two pipe bombs were planted. More were found. Molotov cocktails were found. One police officer was beaten and dragged into a mob. We saw people breaking into a window of the Capitol, and they were using a police shield to do it. There is no way to uncouple this from national security, and there is no way that national security can be, I guess, restored until this is dealt with. And the reason why is because those people were supposedly protesters, but protesters don't carry around those items. How did they get to those items to the Capitol? How come nobody saw them? How did they get into the Capitol? How did they know where to go? To places that weren't identified or places that were nondescript. What were their motives once they got in there? This is a part of the problem that we're facing here. There's no way to deal with this without fixing some very serious blame to some very influential people. You know, I'm hinting at what's been called an inside job here. These folks had some help one way or another to get in there. And that is a direct impact on national security because these are members of Congress. One member, a former Secret Service deputy director, told me yesterday, the only way to prevent this from happening again is to declare any joint meeting of Congress a national special security event, just like the State of the Union is, just like the inaugural is, just like any meeting where you have a joint session of Congress because of the import of the people that are there at that time. The only way to deal with that is from a national security perspective. So that has to be dealt with as we look at this. And the other part of this, too, is where did this come from? It came from the commander in chief. And that's what the investigators are looking at right now. They believe that this was a call to action that was answered.
We'll come back to more of the inside job thread and see what type of collaboration may have happened. First, we'll take a break. We'll come back with more issues in the news.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for The New Statesman. J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. And our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Emily, I want to go to you. Mitch McConnell has been quoted as saying that he supports impeachment of President Trump and conviction. And he thinks that the Republican Party reportedly needs to make a break. A clean break from Trump. This is obviously new, hasn't happened before. He's been a staunch supporter of the president and the policies that he's put forward, the judges, all of these things. What has been the tipping point for McConnell? Is it really the policy? Was it something else? Was it really the sight of the violence? And what effectively can he do? Can he really make a break from Trump and still have a viable U.S. political party?
It's a really interesting question and also situation that we find ourselves unpacking here. One wonders if this had happened during Trump's term and not at the very, very end of it, if McConnell would be distancing himself similarly. I think a few things are going on here. First of all, while he did stand by for the many weeks that Trump was saying that the election had been stolen, you know, sort of refused to denounce the conspiracy theories, one might say created some of the conditions that led to the anger and frustration that we saw on January 6th, I can appreciate that seeing a mob storm your workplace can change one's mind. I think the cynical read is that they now have an opportunity to make it so that Trump can never hold office again. They can just get rid of this political opponent and sort of reclaim the Republican Party from Trump. The problem is, as we saw yesterday, there was much ado about the fact that Liz Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter, this prominent figure in the Republican Party, was voting for impeachment. Well, only 9 House Republicans joined her, right? And so even if McConnell's privately suggesting that he supports impeachment, I don't know that he's going to get 16 other Republican senators to join him to get Democrats to that 2/3 majority. And the reason is that if you looked at the YouGov poll that came out right after the storming of the Capitol, 45% of Republicans supported the mob, and 85% of Republicans said they did not support the immediate removal of Trump. So Donald Trump Jr. said at the rally in the morning of January 6th that it's not establishment Republicans' Republican Party, it's his father's Republican Party. And I actually think that there is some truth in that. I think that many elected Republicans know that Trump still enjoys, or believe that Trump still enjoys a lot of support with their voters. So I don't know where the Republican Party goes from here. If these sort of quote unquote establishment Republicans can claw back those voters, if they can actually purge Trump from the party, or if in letting this go on for 4 years, they've lost control.
Let me throw some more cynicism at you, Emily. In recent days, major corporations have said that they will withdraw and cease funding of Republican candidates going forward that have associated themselves with the Republican Party because of the violence at the Capitol. One could say that in that sense, Mitch McConnell might be even more anxious for a conviction of Donald Trump than Chuck Schumer, the incoming majority leader, if the corporate donor spigot is turned off by association with Trump. Thoughts?
I actually thought, I had this thought the other day, that they have to be more afraid of capitalism than Trump supporters to do this, right? So they have to be more, convinced that their backers, that their mega donors and the companies that support them, they have to be more afraid that they're going to walk away than the Trump supporters are going to walk away. And right now, I could be wrong. I'm just not sure that that's the calculation that most Republican senators have made at this point.
Okay. JJ, we have more troops right now in Washington, D.C. than we have in Afghanistan. The building where I work is completely surrounded by troops. There are military checkpoints that you would see when you're doing overseas reporting. I'm not going to say unprecedented, because we had 9/11. We've had other situations where we have seen National Guard here in the city, but I don't know that I've seen this many and have them on such a sense of high alert. What's the prospect for security here in the nation's capital going forward? Because people stormed the Capitol to interrupt a process, and that's essentially what happens every day in that building. There are processes that go on, and there are dozens, maybe hundreds of buildings in Washington, D.C. area where that same thing happened, where the process of government goes on. Going forward, how are we going to secure this city for an inauguration, and even after that, for just the business of everyday government?
Well, you know, I agree with what you said about the overseas thing. I looked at some of the security on Capitol Hill, and looking through that fence, and I just saw these hundreds, then I guess looking at the totality of it, thousands of guards on the Capitol grounds and around the Capitol grounds. It reminded me of one time when I was in the Green Zone in Baghdad. And I thought, wow, this is just like that. The only thing that was different was the flag was a different type of flag and the buildings looked different. The prospect for security during the inauguration is nothing to worry about, because that is locked down and it's taken care of, because the Secret Service has been planning for this for a year or more. And this climate that we're in, nothing is being left to chance. Moving forward, people have been awakened by what took place. Even those who won't vote a certain way on the Hill in terms of impeachment or not, or people who won't acknowledge what really took place, the people who are responsible for their safety, they're not playing those games. The people that are responsible for the safety of members of Congress and for people in the city, and I would argue around the country, recognize that their jobs, their livelihoods, and their own lives are at stake if they don't get this right moving forward. So security moving forward, we're back in the same kind of place we were after 9/11, because I was at the VOA building on 9/11, and I can recall standing on the roof watching the Pentagon burn. But that came after I had been warned by some people that I knew in law enforcement to get out of D.C. just before that plane crashed in Shanksville, which we later learned was intended for the Capitol. We're in that same mindset and situation now, because people are going to have to deal with what led up to this and how do we fix this. It's going to be a long, arduous process to get to the bottom of it. There are going to be hundreds of people arrested and most likely convicted, but they're not leaving anything to chance on the security front. And in terms of making Washington secure again, it will happen.
Emily, from a security and political standpoint, the countries in Europe during the 80s especially dealt with violent factions within their own government, within their own country. We think of the Red Army. We think of the Basque separatist movement that had kidnappings, bombings, murders, these sorts of things. They were long-term things. These lasted for years and years and years. They were finally excised from that society and from those governments, but they lasted for years and years. Is the feeling around Washington among the political class that this is something that is more of a brief thing, more of a thing that sort of fades away as Trump leaves office? Or are we in for something more akin to what the European nations went through during the 80s period?
I think before January 6th, there were many people who believed that this was going to be over on January 20th, that the kind of rhetoric and conspiracy theory and the sort of threats to members of your own party, that was going to go away when Donald Trump stopped being president. I think that January 6th drove home for a lot of people that this is not going away. And a difference from some of the European situations that you've just mentioned is that this is one of our two major political parties. I think that the Republican Party has a long road ahead of it. A new member of the Republican Party just said that she's going to bring articles of impeachment against Joe Biden on January 21st, right? So there's still this fervor for Trump and this desire to fight Biden. And I think that the polarization, the intensity of the grievance on some sides is not going away. I think a concern is that unless there is accountability for those who stormed the Capitol and those who and cited the storming of the Capitol, that this could happen. This could easily happen again.
And the Democrats, Emily, are going to have a real balancing act when they come back into session. You're going to have an incoming president who has an agenda, who has, by nature, a desire to cooperate across the aisle. It's sort of his hallmark of his governing style. And then you have to balance this positioning of his political agenda with a trial of the former president. How can the Democrats handle this balancing act? Is there a thought even to delaying having the trial until maybe after the first 100 days of the Biden administration to give it a chance to get up and on its feet?
They have a real, I mean, we've been talking about divisions in the Republican Party, but the Democrats have this massive task ahead of them, in particular Joe Biden. I know that he was reportedly asking Mitch McConnell and trying to get an answer from the Senate parliamentarian if they could perhaps do a half day split where half of the day is on the impeachment trial and then the other half of the day is dedicated to getting some of his nominees through the nomination process and into their jobs. The thing is that he had a massive task ahead of this before January 6th. He had the economy, he had vaccinations. We have thousands of people dying every day from COVID-19. He had going back to allies and saying, sorry, Foreign Minister of Luxembourg, that you refused to see Mike Pompeo, you know, in the last week. But if we established ties between the US and Europe, all of this had to happen. And now Biden also has this. I think they will probably try to find a way to either get through the impeachment trial quickly or to have it be only part of the day or to have it so that it's not the only thing that the Biden administration is doing for the first 100 days. I will say that I think that if a mob had not stormed the Capitol, I think Biden's inclination very much would have been to try to move forward and focus on the future. But I think events clearly have forced his hand because the House impeached Trump. And so now you sort of have to deal with the past before you can look only to the future.
Dealing with that as part of moving forward. JJ, I just want to ask you about the ongoing investigations now. We've had dozens of people arrested, identified, and case files opened by the FBI. There are also reports that you alluded to earlier, there being collaboration possibly with government officials and police who may have helped the insurrection by giving even guided tours to riot people who would turn out to be leaders of the riots the next day, congressmen or congressmen's staff, congressional staff. What is going to be the punishment for people who are found to have been collaborators? What happens to someone if we find out that's true?
Some people are facing the possibility of years in jail, in prison. You know, it really depends on what's found out. So I can't really answer that question, you know, from a general point of view. It was a crime. You know, that's a crime scene, as you mentioned earlier. This is a situation where there was everything from simple trespassing to assault. There was murder. There are firearms in there. You know, as you mentioned, there are situations where people say that they believe that there are members of Congress or staff that brought people in the day before to give them what they call reconnaissance tours to find places and people. These are very serious charges. And so you're talking about the possibility of prison time for some people if they are found to have done something like this. Certainly, if you're a representative or a staffer who helped facilitate something that led to murder. The other thing that I think sort of puts this into perspective, too, I still haven't confirmed this yet, but there are reports that in one particular staffer's office, Ayanna Pressley, there were panic buttons that they had installed in the office that they said they reached for those panic buttons during this problem, during this event, during this situation, and they weren't there. Those buttons had been ripped out. The chief of staff for Representative Pressley told the Boston Globe that those buttons had been torn away. If this is true, this is not something that protesters did the day of this rally. They say this had to have happened before the riots took place. So there are some very serious charges, and I would imagine very serious time if people are found to have collaborated with the people who committed those crimes in the Capitol.
I know it's unprecedented time to keep saying that, but I thank you all for really addressing these things with such insight and such knowledge and such calm. It becomes very personal when it's here in Washington, D.C. amongst us. And again, I appreciate your candor and your expertise. That is all the time we have. Thanks to our panelists, Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for The New Statesman, and J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. This program is produced by The Voice of America. I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Anna Mateo and Brian Lin bring us a story about award-winning librarians. Armin Kasabian answers a question from a learner in this week's Ask a Teacher. We close our show with an American story. This week, it is Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart. But first, here is John Russell.
Several groups representing scientists and doctors have expressed concerns over India's vaccine approval process. The concerns come after India approved a vaccine by Indian drug maker Bharat Biotech. The vaccine was approved for emergency use on January 3rd. Before it had completed late clinical trials. Late clinical trial data gives evidence about how effective a vaccine is in preventing illness from coronavirus infections. Many scientists have warned that approving a vaccine without evidence from late trials is risky, and a lack of clarity in the approval process could lead many people to delay getting the vaccine or to refuse to get it at all. More than 10.4 million coronavirus cases have been reported among India's nearly 1.4 billion people. Bharat Biotech's vaccine was one of two that India approved for emergency use. The second was a form of the AstraZeneca vaccine. It is made by the world's largest vaccine manufacturer, Serum Institute of India. Serum Institute's vaccine was approved because of partial results from studies in Britain and Brazil that showed it was about 70% effective. At first, a member of India's COVID-19 task force said the Bharat Biotech vaccine would be used as a backup. Backup is a term that means something can be used to replace or support another person or thing. But on January 5th, health officials said Bharat Biotech's vaccine would be made available to people who give their permission. People given the vaccine will also need to get follow-up visits. The move suggests India will send out both vaccines, but it remains unclear which states will receive which vaccine and for what reasons. On January 16th, India will begin giving vaccines to an estimated 30 million doctors, nurses, and other frontline workers. After that, the shots will start going to around 270 million Indians who are either over age 50 or have other health issues, sometimes called comorbidities. China and Russia have also released vaccines while late clinical trials were still going on. But India, which is the world's largest manufacturer of vaccines, has drawn criticism for not being clear in its approval process and for using two different standards. A standard is a level of quality that is considered acceptable. The group of experts that approved the vaccines met three times. In the first two meetings, on December 30th and January 1st, they were not pleased with Bharat Biotech's application. They asked for more data on its ability to prevent illness from COVID-19 Notes from the meeting show. The AstraZeneca vaccine, meanwhile, was approved on January 1st. Notes from the January 2nd meeting show that the company presented updated data. But it is not clear what new evidence led the experts to change their minds. Dr. Vinita Bal of India's National Institute of Immunology noted the need for transparent approvals that include data to confirm vaccine effectiveness. This is a process that Indian government officials are themselves sabotaging, she said. India's top drug official would not comment on the issue. The identities of the experts that approved the vaccines have not been made public. I'm John Russell.
Anyone who loves to read loves a library. The sight of thousands of books organized on shelves, the smell of old books mixed with new ones, the sound of a librarian silencing a noisy visitor are all part of a book lover's dream. But libraries are much more than that. In this digital age, libraries and the experts who run them help bridge the digital divide between those with technology and those without. Librarians help people find important information in a huge sea of material. They support literacy and a love of reading.
This is true in normal times, but libraries and librarians are even more valuable since the 2020 coronavirus, which forced most students into online education. The American Library Association started the I Love My Librarian Award in 2008. Each year, 10 are chosen for the award. ALA President Julius C. Jefferson, Jr. noted the extreme difficulty caused by the pandemic in his praise for the 2021 award winners. Librarians have risen to the occasion, he said, providing much-needed resources to their communities from a safe distance.
Library users nominate their favorite librarian for the award. They are chosen for their expert knowledge about books, their support for learning and reading, and for their contributions to the community. Each winning librarian receives $5,000 and a $750 donation to their library from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. The Associated Press reported on the winners for 2021. And now the envelope, please. Jayante Adelman is the library director at the Haywood Public Library in Haywood, California. The website ilovelibraries.org explained her work during the COVID-19 crisis. She made sure everyone, but especially people in need, could easily get a library card online and devices to help bridge the digital divide.
At Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas, librarian Sean Bird made sure that all students taking classes online because of the coronavirus received laptops. One student wrote about Bird, "That dude changed my life. He is the reason I graduated."
Jessica Bell of Boston's MGH Institute of Health Professions, one for making the library a world-class resource for teaching and learning. She also led online events to keep students calm and connected.
Naomi Bishop at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Phoenix won for being a voice and leader for social justice. Her nominators said the local medical community turned to Bishop for up-to-date research about public health and safety best practices.
Jesse Braun of Beverly Vista Middle School Library in Beverly Hills, California, won for leadership in providing online and physical resources during the pandemic. His nomination states that he grew the library into a beloved student-centered environment where every child, every teacher, and every family could feel at home.
Adeline Estrada Huerta of the Sacramento Public Library in California won for outstanding outreach services to Spanish-speaking families and Russian as well. This tech-savvy librarian also adapted the library programming to a virtual format.
Librarian Jianye He at the University of California, Berkeley, won for building community and helping Chinese teachers. Her nominees describe her as a home away from home.
Jane E. Martellino at the International School at Dundee in Greenwich, Connecticut, won for creating an exciting culture of literacy. She has helped countless children discover the joy of reading through her programs. During the pandemic, she created a tablet-based online product for students to access digital books, stories, and learning resources.
Jennifer L. Newcomb at Northeastern High School in Manchester, Pennsylvania, is a research partner and source of support for both teachers and students. One nomination letter said that Newcomb noticed a student who seemed hungry, sitting alone in the library at lunch. So she began bringing food for him every day and checking in with his teacher. The boy, who had been struggling in his studies, became an honor roll student.
Elizabeth Moreau Nikolai from the Anchorage Public Library in Alaska won for promoting literacy and other services for Alaska's young people. Her nomination said her passion for equitable programming and collections have helped shape the library's goals of inclusion and service to the entire community. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Ana Mateo.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Listio from Indonesia. I would like to know, what is the difference between attempt and try? Thank you very much. Dear Lestia, thank you for writing, and yes, we will try to help. The words try and attempt have very similar meanings, but there is a small yet important difference between try and attempt. Try is more informal. You use it while speaking with friends and family. Attempt is more formal. You often use it while speaking and writing about reaching a goal. Try means to make an effort to do something. When you try something, you may not care about the result. The effort is on doing the activity more than reaching a goal. We also use try for doing something that we may have not done before. Native English speakers often use the word try when speaking about something they want to do in daily activities. Here are two examples.
I tried a new shirt on and loved it, so I bought it. I went to my favorite restaurant and tried a soup for the first time.
When you say, I tried a soup, it means just to taste it. However, it will mean something different if you say, I tried to eat soup. It means you tried, but could not. Attempt also means to try to do something. The meaning is similar to try, but the result is more important than just doing the activity. You use it to show an activity or a situation that is more difficult or more official.
I attempted to get a good grade on the TOEFL test, and I was successful. He attempted to climb Mount Everest, but the conditions were too dangerous.
Yes, you still can use try in place of attempt in both examples. But you want to use attempt for something special and important in someone's life. I'm happy that you are trying to use new words every day. And I look forward to seeing your attempt to use them in the comments. I'm Armin Kasabian.
Today, we present the short story, The Telltale Heart, by Edgar Allan Poe. Here is Shep O'Neill with the story.
True, nervous, very, very nervous I have been, and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed them. Above all, it was the sense of hearing. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in the underworld. How then am I mad? Observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold, I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a bird, a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell on me, my blood ran cold. And so, very slowly, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and free myself of the eye forever. Now, this is the point. You think that I am mad. Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely and carefully I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night, late at night, I turned the lock of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening big enough for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed, that no light shone out. And then I stuck in my head. I moved it slowly, very slowly, so that I might not interfere with the old man's sleep. And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern just so much that a single thin ray of light fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, but I found the eye always closed, And so it was impossible to do the work, for it was not the old man who was a problem for me, but his evil eye. On the eighth night, I was more than usually careful in opening the door. I had my head in and was about to open the lantern when my finger slid on a piece of metal and made a noise. The old man sat up in bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept still and said nothing. I did not move a muscle for a whole hour. During that time, I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed, listening, just as I have done, night after night. Then I heard a noise, and I knew it was the sound of human terror. It was the low sound that arises from the bottom of the soul. I know the sound well. Many a night, late at night, when all the world slept, it has welled up from deep within my own chest. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt, and I felt sorry for him, although I laughed to myself. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first noise when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been, ever since, growing upon him. When I had waited a long time, without hearing him lie down, I decided to open a little, a very, very little crack in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how carefully, carefully. Finally, a single ray of light shot from out and fell full upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide, wide open, and I grew angry as I looked at it. I saw it clearly, all a dull blue with a horrible veil over it that chilled my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the light exactly upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but a kind of oversensitivity? Now, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when inside a piece of cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my anger, but even yet I kept still. I hardly breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I attempted to keep the ray of light upon the eye, but the beating of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every second. The old man's terror must have been extreme. The beating grew louder, I say, louder every moment. And now, at the dead hour of the night, in the horrible silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet for some minutes longer I stood still, but the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst, and now a new fear seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud shout, I threw open the lantern and burst into the room. He cried once, once only. Without delay, I forced him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled to find the action so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a quiet sound. This, however, did not concern me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it stopped. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the body. I placed my hand over his heart and held it there many minutes. There was no movement. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. If still you think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise steps I took for hiding the body. I worked quickly, but in silence. First of all, I took apart the body. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three pieces of wood from the flooring and placed his body parts under the room. I then replaced the wooden board so well that no human eye, not even his, could have seen anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no mark of any kind, no blood whatever. I had been too smart for that. A tub had caught all. When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. As a clock sounded the hour, there came a noise at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what had I now to fear? There entered three men, who said they were officers of the police. A cry had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of a crime had been aroused. Information had been given at the police office, and the officers had been sent to search the building. I smiled, for what had I to fear? The cry, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I said, was not in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I told them to search well. I led them at length to his room. I brought the chairs there and told them to rest. I placed my own seat upon the very place under which lay the body of the victim. The officers were satisfied. I was completely at ease. They sat, and while I answered happily, they talked of common things. But after a while, I felt myself getting weak and wished them gone. My head hurt, and I had ringing in my ears. But still they sat and talked. The ringing became more severe. I talked more freely to do away with the feeling, but it continued until at length I found that the noise was not within my ears. I talked more, and with a heightened voice, yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound like a watch makes when inside a piece of cotton. I had trouble breathing, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more loudly, but the noise increased. I stood up and argued about silly things in a high voice and with violent hand movements, but the noise kept increasing. Why would they not be gone? I walked across the floor with heavy steps, as if excited to anger by the observations of the men, but the noise increased. What could I do? I swung my chair and moved it upon the floor. But the noise continually increased. It grew louder, 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 and still the men talked pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? No, no, they heard. They suspected. They knew. They were making a joke of my horror. This, I thought, and this, I think. But anything was better than this pain. I could bear those smiles no longer. I felt I must scream or die. And now, again, louder, louder, louder. Villains, I cried, pretend no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the floorboards. Here, here, it is the beating of his hideous heart.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.